Welcome to the Rethink ELA podcast, hosted by English language arts teacher Michelle Waters. Prepare to receive strategies, products, and expert advice tailored to help teachers build social awareness, student agency, and voice in their ELA classrooms.
Welcome back to the Rethink ELA podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Boyd Waters. I just finished my first semester of being a doctoral student and my first semester without my own classroom in 10 years. I'm sad, but also excited about the projects I'm involved in, including the opportunity to serve as the Oklahoma Writing Project graduate assistant and co-editor of the Oklahoma English Journal. By the way, we need your writing and your artwork. As part of a grant received by Oklahoma Writing Project, I spent a day with a few other teacher consultants helping to plan a project situated at the Chisholm Trail Heritage Center in Duncan, Oklahoma. The center features artwork by Oklahoma artists and an education program that helps students connect with the art through writing. And that's what OWP is working towards doing, helping teachers develop lesson plans they can use in their classes, along with implementation support, and that will be published online for other teachers to use with their classes, on physical or virtual field trips to the museum. I mention this because my guest this episode is Shay Parton, who recently accepted a position as Visiting Assistant Professor of Curriculum and Instruction at Purdue University. Her scholarship focuses on the ways in which place shapes culturally sustaining teaching and on teaching in rural contexts. When I first heard about her, this caught my attention because I've spent 8 years of my career teaching in rural schools and communities. Additionally, my father's side of the family is from and still lives in rural Oklahoma. I have a long history of grappling with my rural and suburban identities, even now, though I've spent the past 26 years living in rural communities. Not only did the Heritage Center, with its very rural atmosphere, remind me of Dr. Parton's work, but it made me think about how we can connect literacy to the places that are part of our students' identities. Check out the following messages, and we'll be right back.
When it comes to reaching students through literature, finding reliable resources is challenging. Your search is over. Rethink ELA Podcast is here to provide student-tested, research-based strategies, products, and advice. Here's your host, Michelle Waters.
Welcome back to the Rethink ELA Podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Boyd Waters, and today I have with me Dr. Shay Parton. Welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I am so glad that you accepted my invitation. I had the opportunity to listen to you present your research, and I was super excited to hear it. And I thought, this is somebody whose work the English teachers at Rethink ELA need to hear. So if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and what it is that you do and who you are.
Sure. So really, it all started growing up in a rural community. I came from a town of 800 people. I grew up on a farm of 80 acres, and that was just like normal, you know, until I left and it wasn't normal anymore. And so learning how to be outside of a rural place was a little bit difficult for me, especially when I went to Purdue University, which has like 40,000 people.
Yeah.
And so like, I just never thought about how much where I'm from impacted who I was as a person. And then after I finished my teacher's license, I got my bachelor's in literature first. And then I came back to do my teacher's license. And after I finished that, I ended up teaching in a rural school and not too far. I actually lived in my hometown and then commuted the 45 minutes to my rural school where I taught. But it was a whole new set of like learning how to be in a place because I thought that I would feel at home there because I was a rural kid and went to a rural school. And so I thought I would fit in teaching at a rural school. But in my teacher education program, we focused on teaching for suburban and urban areas. And so I tried to employ that in my classroom. And it didn't always go as well as what I had hoped or what I would have liked. And so based on that experience, I felt like I had more questions about how to be a good teacher than answers. And so I decided to go back to graduate school. After I got my master's at Purdue, I went to do my doctoral work at the University of Texas at Austin in an urban focused program. And I was one of two rural people in that program.
Oh, wow.
And we both just really struggled to figure out how to be in an urban place where the buildings are so close and there isn't a lot of green space, to communicate with people who largely came from urban areas and didn't share the same kind of like language practices that we did.
Right.
And so through all of those experiences, I started to think about, well, if I'm having trouble with this, and pretty much everybody who grows up in a rural place has to leave a rural place to get a college education or a university education to become a teacher, then there's got to be other teachers out there that are struggling with this in a similar way to me. Absolutely. And so then I decided to do my doctoral work on rural out-migrant teachers. So teachers who grew up in a rural place and then ended up settling in like large suburban or urban areas to teach, and think about like how where they're from has impacted not only who they are as people and how they understand themselves in terms of like cultural and language practice, but also how they understand themselves as teachers and the kind of practices that they employ in their classroom. And so that's sort of my research focus, is thinking about how place, specifically for me, rurality, how that impacts the way that teachers understand themselves as teachers.
Right.
And the way that teachers then construct their pedagogical practices based on not only, you know, who they are as rural out-migrant people, but also how they've learned to be teachers in programs that are mostly located in large suburbs, suburban or urban areas, you know.
Yeah, and you know, listening to your story and talking about how you left a rural area and then went to, you know, the city in order to get your education and do some teaching and that sort of thing, I'm thinking, and it, like you saying, it all comes down to place. I ended up having the opposite experience somewhat, mm-hmm. because I grew up in a suburb and went to school, you know, at a large suburban school, and went to a smaller university, but again, it was still in a city. And then, you know, of course I'm going to OU for my, went there for my master's and now for my doctorate. But I went from this suburban area to a tiny rural school. And so that was kind of way different for me. You know, for example, you know, I this is kind of a joke that I tell, but the school was so small that, you know, a kid would sneeze on one end of the school and somebody would Snapchat bless you from the town over. and so just kind of the way everybody knew everybody, and we'd get mm-hmm. a new kid and the kid was like, oh yeah, I used to go to school here, and they would already know everyone. So they'd come mm-hmm. in and I would just welcome them by their name, and they'd go choose the group they wanted to sit in, and it was all good. And so I kind of had to change some of my mindset and then reach back into my family, because my father's side of the family is from southwestern Oklahoma, a very rural area. And we would visit every year, and I would get to stay during the summer sometimes. And so I kind of had to reach back to those influences and thinking about what that was like in order to understand the kids that were in my classroom.
And it's great that you had that to draw on, because some folks don't.
Yeah, I would have been completely lost, you know, when the kid walked in with a, you know, broken bones because they were out riding their dirt bike and mm-hmm. like, what?
Yeah. Well, and I contributed a chapter to this book by Lisa Eckert and Janet Alsup. It's a collection of rural teaching narratives. And uh-huh. in it, there are two chapters written by friends of mine who also went to Purdue. But their experience is your experience. They grew up yeah. very suburban. And then they came into these rural schools and had like no idea how to interact and be in a place where everybody has really grown up with everybody else. The students have been with each other since kindergarten, and yep. the teachers have, you know, there is some high teacher turnover, but at the school where I taught, a lot of the teachers that taught there went to that same school.
Yeah.
And graduated from there. And so, you yep. know, there's this yep. like struggle of like insider outsider.
Mm-hmm.
And navigating that and trying to figure out like, okay, how do I fit in here? And that was even a struggle for me, even though I was a rural person. Mentor was the FACTS teacher, the Family and Consumer Sciences teacher, because there were only 4 teachers in the entire English department for grades 7 through 12. And all of us were like young teachers, like new teachers. Right. And so like, in order to have a mentor, I had to go outside of my department even because none of the people in my department were better enough to be a mentor, you know?
Absolutely. But, yeah. I ended up having to kind of create my own PLC on Twitter and Facebook and just, you know, pulling people in. That's one of the reasons why I built Rethink ELA. But you know, that whole, you were talking about, you know, insider outsider, I was at my rural school for 6 years. And even after 6 years, I was still finding out how everybody was connected. Oh, okay, you're so-and-so's little brother and you're the principal's cousin and, you know, you're the superintendent's, you know, all these connections that you know, and you lived across the street from the counselor for 30 years, you know, that sort of thing. All of these little connections that you just don't see in a suburban and urban school. And then, you know, you go to Walmart and it's kind of like rural meetup day because you meet, you see all these people that you know. Yeah. Like, so I can't, you know, go to Walmart in my pajama pants. Not that I would, but you can't because you're going to see one of your kids.
Or like, you know, if you're trying to, heaven forbid, you're trying to buy yourself a drink, you know, or there was something like that, you know.
Even like, what do I have paper, in my shopping cart?
I know. But the FACTS teacher was like, you know, these kids can smell city on people and they are, you know, warming up to you more than they do some of the other folks who try to teach here because they can tell that you're not city. But even though you're not city, you're still not this town.
And yeah, so, you're not their little town.
Right. And
you're
so
that other little town.
So you're faring better than other folks who have come in here. Yeah. But, you know, you still didn't grow up here. You didn't come from here. And so there's still a little bit of who the heck is this person and why is she telling me what to do?
You know? Exactly. Exactly. And so, you know, when I walked into that situation, you know, kind of having been from the city and having attitudes and ways of doing things that were more city-like and more larger school-like, I had to try to figure out how do I connect with the kids in my class. And one of the things that I figured out was you have to listen to them. You got to ask them.
And sometimes I feel like that's hard. That's hard because you've gone through this entire teacher preparation program that sort of like, in one way or another, even if it's student-centered, still situates you at the center of the universe of the classroom. Because, and that just sort of makes sense. But at the same time, like, you have to consider place and you have to consider where you are and how that impacts how students think about learning, how students think about knowledge, what knowledge students think is important versus the knowledge that you're coming in with and deem important, where the tensions are with that, and like how you have a conversation about curriculum and what knowledge is worth most in certain situations and where power lies. Like all of that is largely built in and framed by where people are. And I don't think that we think about that enough. And so that's another reason for the work that I'm doing, because I realized through my own sort of movement in and across places, especially in and across rural and urban places, that the ways of knowing and being and understanding the world, ways of interacting and speaking, are just different. It's funny. I just got finished, editing an author talk with Christopher Barzek, and the amount of cooperative overlapping that happened in that interview, it wasn't apparent to me at the time we were talking because it's just normal conversational practice for me. But in editing, it was like, oh man, I bet this would drive some of my urban friends absolutely insane because, because they're very much a wait your turn, take your turn.
Yes.
But I am not that way. So
I think I'm not either, but I grew up in a household where my father was from southwestern Oklahoma.
Right.
But my mother was from Omaha, Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently in Omaha, Nebraska, there's no cooperative overlapping. You wait your turn. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so I was trying to be a cooperative overlapper and mom wasn't having that. And so I kind of, she would correct me.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of something that I think about and try not to do. But, you know, when I get excited about something, I forget and I'm like jumping in there.
Yeah, it's hard. I have trouble keeping myself from doing it. And I just think that, you know, you're drawn to practices that make sense to you. You know,
yeah.
You're drawn to practices that help you build conversation and help you build understanding with someone else, even if it doesn't suit the other person, or even if it makes it difficult for the other person to build understanding. Mm-hmm. And so I wish we had more conversations in classrooms across all educational levels about, like, what are your preferred methods of participation? What have you noticed about the way that you talk with other people, and how might that, how might what helps you not be helpful to someone else in this class who has
yeah.
also defined, like, what is most helpful to them? And then what can we do in this class around our conversational practices to make sure that, you know, we're trying to balance things as much as possible so that everybody is allowed and space is made for everyone to have the opportunity to participate in ways that help them build knowledge and learn best. And that's never a conversation.
Yeah.
It's just assumed,
and that's so
that,
important.
Yeah. It's just assumed that everyone's going to participate in the same way, which is always an urban normative metrocentric way.
Right. And so you end up in a rural school where you're, you know, presenting or, you know, giving instructions, and some kid interrupts you, and they're not really interrupting. They're trying to continue the conversation. They've got excited about something, or they have a question about something. And so they jump in there,
mm-hmm.
and they're doing, you know, what is common, normal, accepted practice for them. And then you're, you know, getting angry at them and they don't know why.
Right.
And so as teachers, we've got to step back and understand that that's not what's happening there.
Right. Or at least ask the question, like,
yeah.
Or just come at it from an appreciative and asset-based stance, yeah. you know, like,
they're paying attention, they're listening.
Right. Well, and just like, not, I don't know why sometimes we end up with this orientation that, like, all kids are out to get us, you know,
right.
That they're all out to, like, distract us, or they're all out to, like, undermine us, or they're all out to, like, I don't know, just be annoying in some way, you know, like,
yeah.
like that's not it at all. And so when we come at them with that assumption, then it
yeah.
just fractures relationships and we can't teach.
Absolutely. And that's something that I figured out, you know, again, probably the second year at that rural school, is I need to partner with the kids, because it's just me on this end of the building. I'm the only English teacher, 9th through 11th grade. It's me against them, or it's me with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I started partnering with them, listening to them, you know, what do you want out of your education? What do you want to do with your life? What's important to you right now? And started seeing them as, you know, cooperative learners along with me, instead of, you know, them having deficits, then that changed everything.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's that whole, you know, sage on the stage versus guide on the side thing, you know?
Exactly.
And I think that it's hard sometimes to inhabit both of those spaces for various different reasons. Because we're trying to strike a balance between being a guide, but also having more experience and, you know, expert knowledge of our content area, and, like, trying to communicate all of those things with students in a way that's going to be helpful to them. But sometimes what we think is going to be helpful for them isn't.
Exactly.
And so I think that considering place and place-based modes and methods of communication, of learning, of valuing knowledge, of being and understanding the world, like, all of those things are really important and need, I think, more consideration in teacher preparation programs, in professional development, and inside the classroom.
And I think, you know, considering place, you know, there are a lot of rural areas. There may not be a whole lot of people out there, but there are quite a few teachers that are going to teach in rural places as well as suburban and urban. So, you know, we ought to cover all three spaces, but I think it just, we need to really focus on being student-centered and figuring out what do the kids right in front of me want? What do they need? For example, I had a class, you know, that had about 20 kids, all but one of them were boys, and they'd known each other, you know, like you said, since kindergarten. They loved the outdoors, hunting, fishing, riding their dirt bikes, and they hated reading and they hated writing, and they were sure to tell me that on the first day of school. And then they had, you know, figured out how to kind of derail a conversation in class, however, whatever direction they wanted it to go, and kind of had worked that down to a fine art. And so I thought, you know what? We can't do that. I can't, you know, kick them out of class every time they get off track or what have you, because we're never going to get anywhere. And so I asked them, you know, what their interests were. What are your hobbies? What was the last book that you read or listened to that you liked? What movies, video games, all of this, and kind of put all that together and realize these kids love nature and love the outdoors. And so I chose some short stories for them to see what they thought. To Build a Fire by Jack London, The Bass of the River and Sheila Mant, and The Most Dangerous Game. And they loved those stories, mm-hmm. and they read them in literature circles, and they talked about them, they argued about them. And like I said, these are kids that hated reading and writing. And they wrote in response to these stories. And it was all because I honored or valued what interested them right now today.
Yeah, and I had a very similar experience, except for I didn't respond in the same way. I sort of stuck to my training about mm-hmm. what great literature was, but I was teaching the Awakening by Kate Chopin, and a couple of my kids who weren't usually into things that we did in class were talking, and they were having a pretty spirited conversation, and I knew that they couldn't be talking about the book. So I walked over and I was like, so what are y'all talking about? And they were like, hey, Miss P, you ever read Where the Red Fern Grows? And I was like, yeah, but it's been a really long time ago. And they were like, man, that's such a good book. Like, that book made me cry. It made me think of my own hunting dogs. Like, man, that book was so yeah. good. Like, why can't we read stuff like that here now? And I was like, well, first of all, it's like, you know, a late elementary, early middle grades yeah. novel, and you're a sophomore. Right? Because I had these ideas about, like, what is sort of a level of literature students needed to be reading. And then I was also like, you know, that's not what I assigned. I'm sure I took that attitude. Like, that's not what I assigned. That's not what you're supposed to be talking about. So can you at least try to talk about this book if you've read any of it, you know? And then, right. and then I went to, like, you know, go back and like, that's a really terrible attitude to have. It's a terrible response. And I feel so, like, guilty about that response, because they were telling me
yeah.
that they're readers. They were telling me yeah. what they wanted to read, and they wanted to read things that they saw themselves in.
Yeah.
And so it was in my yep. dissertation research that I realized, when I was working with these teachers who had extensive classroom yep. libraries and who practiced reading workshop, it was the first time I ever thought to ask the question, do you have any rural books mm-hmm. in your library? You know, like, what rural titles do you have in your classroom library? And, like, that is silly that it took me that long to ask that question, because I was a rural student and I was a rural teacher. And so, like, and thinking about, like, bishops, mirrors, windows, and sliding glass yeah. doors, like, I never provided mirrors for my students. Like, Where the Red Fern Grows is probably the last mirror they had
yep.
until they got, you know, since they had gotten into high school. And any canonical work that they read that had rural people in it, the rural yeah. was probably largely pathologized. If you think about things like Of Mice and Men, right? Like, it's something to be fixed. It's something to be cured. Or Faulkner, or, like, really any of uh-huh. these canonical writers where, like, stuff takes place in a rural setting. And so, like, I should have listened, and but I didn't hear what they were saying. And so finally in my dissertation research, I thought to ask the question, and these teachers who, understood themselves to be culturally sustaining teachers and who were working in schools that sat on like the fringe of the city and bordered urban and rural spaces, and so had urban and rural students in the same school, didn't have any mirrors for their rural students. And so I was like, this is an issue. This is a very big problem.
And I think part of the problem too is that there, it seems like there's not a whole lot of authors who, with a rural background, who are writing those rural stories. So we need to convince more students living in rural settings or from rural settings to write their stories.
And I think a huge part of that is that publishing companies don't understand that they need to market books that way. Because, you know, they'll market stuff as urban fiction, but they won't market stuff as rural fiction. And Melissa Wyatt, who wrote Funny How Things Change, which is an excellent book, and was also out during the time that I was a teacher and my students would have loved it. But I didn't know about it because, because they're not marketed. But her publishing company, somebody at the publishing company, I can't remember if it was her editor or it must have been an editor, told her that the book that she wrote wasn't hero-making literature because the protagonist decided not to go off to college because he enjoyed being a mechanic. And so like the assumptions there were, you know, twofold. One is that people like the, people aren't heroes if they stay where they're from to work jobs that they're good at, if those jobs are working class jobs. And the second one is that rural, because Remy in the book is rural, but also just working class people in general don't read. And so why would we need to, publish something for somebody like that who isn't going to read? Because we're trying to sell books, right?
Right. And, you know, if you produce books for people that are mirrors for people, they'll read them.
Right.
And then get them into the hands of teachers to get them into the hands of kids.
Right.
But anyway.
So that's why I embarked on, you know, creating Literacy in Place, my website that has a book list of, I've lost count now of how many books are on there. but there are quite a few. But I would have never known about those had I not actually gone looking for them. And so like as a rural teacher in a classroom where I, and a school where I wore many, many hats, as most rural teachers do, I wouldn't have had time to look for them. And so I'm hoping that Literacy in Place and then also the YouTube series / podcast, Reading Rural Y'all, would, in which I book talk rural fiction, rural YA fiction, in particular, I hope that those make it easier for teachers to find books for students like those students that I dismissed to read. And I'm finding, you know, I found that there were way more out there than I ever thought possible. And now as a member of the Whippoorwill Award Committee for Rural Young Adult Fiction, I just, publishers just keep sending books, and some of them aren't as rural as what you, as what they think they are, you know? But there are a lot of, I'm getting a lot of good rural books in the mail that I never knew existed, especially from indie presses and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so like they're out there. It's just that publishers don't think that people want to read them or are going to read them. And it's an, I think it's largely a numbers game, right? They assume that there are so many more people living in urban areas, but there are 9 million, over 9 million rural students in this country. And that's larger than the top, the biggest 85 school districts in the country. And so like to ignore those students and to not make it easy for them to find books is just, I mean, frankly, annoying to me. And so that's largely why I've also taken on this work, so that teachers can think about, you know, who they are. Because like some of my rural out-migrant teachers had pushed against their rural identities because of sort of the deficit assumptions of like, you know, rural conservative politics, and that rural people are all racist and homophobes, which isn't true. And so because they pushed against that, they sort of steered away from reading rural texts in their own reading life. And then because of that, then they didn't bring them into their classroom library, even though they all talked to me about having readers that they felt those books would be really good for. So thinking about how all of those things entwine, you know, who we are as place connected people, who our students are as place connected people, and then what we can do to work together, like you were talking about before, in order to build a curriculum together that inspires everyone to be lifelong learners and readers. Because my, you know, like my great uncle Leroy and my grandpa Bob, they were from the hills of East Tennessee. And so they were like quintessential hillbillies. They identify as hillbillies. So do I. And the assumption is that hillbillies don't read. My grandpa Bob had a poetry collection that was so worn that everyone was afraid to touch it, you know, because he read it over and over and over again. And they loved to read Westerns. And that's reading, you know, like the definition of what counts as real reading is also something that I think needs examination and unpacking. But the assumption that because they were working class farmers and factory workers, they weren't going to read stuff is super wrong, you know, like so inaccurate. Yes, and so like they deserve to have things. They deserve to have books and poetry and TV shows and films that they can see themselves in and are honored and recognized for all of the nuance and authenticity that rural people possess, instead of constantly just being the end of a redneck joke. And so that's another part of a part of my work and a part of what I think especially like critical rural teaching needs to encompass. Because those people are just used to being the butt of a redneck joke. And they're so much more than that, and they deserve to know that.
Absolutely. So with that in mind, what would you say, or what is your best advice for teachers who are struggling to engage their rural students in literacy practices that they, in class?
Such a big question. And I feel like we've touched on, a lot of it. And that is like, know the literate lives of your students, because they all have a literate life. And that may look different to you than what you automatically assume literacy to be. But there's a literacy to hunting. There's a literacy to farming. There is a literacy to playing football. There, you know what I mean? Like, there's literacy is such a vast, deep concept and practice. And so like allowing your students to talk to you, like I if I were to go back in the classroom again, and I was in a rural classroom, really, if I was in any classroom, the first thing that I would do is ask students to do a project where they outline for me what their literate life looks like. What do they like to do? What do they like to read and not read? Where do they like to do those things? What do they like to write and not write? How do they engage with one another and other people through literacy practice? What does that look like? And how does it contribute to their own ways of knowing and understanding who they are, where they are, and how they can contribute to their communities?
And I think we'd have to recognize too that sometimes, or some of the kids have bought into our definitions, so they don't necessarily see that what they're doing is literacy, that what they're doing is reading, or that it is writing. And so we kind of have to also help them redefine that as part of that project.
Right. I mean, you, in allowing them to talk about those practices, you open up space to show that there's value to them. Another thing that I used to do is, or that I would do now, that I do with my pre-service teachers to show them how they can do this in their future classrooms, is to do like a what we know wall, where I ask students to share bodies of knowledge that they have and are participants in, that school doesn't value. And then they put those up on the wall, and then you see people walk over and you look and you're like, and people make connections with each other, like, oh, you like anime? I like anime too. Or, oh, uh-huh. you're really into fashion and makeup tutorials and stuff? Man, I'm into that too. Or I want to learn more about this. And so now I know that so-and-so knows about this. And so then there's like a visual representation of the wealth of knowledge that exists in our classroom. Yeah. And then we can talk about how all of those things are valuable.
Absolutely.
And so that's one thing. I think that's probably like step one, like acknowledging, honoring, recognizing the funds of knowledge that students are bringing into the classroom as highly valuable and useful in your classroom, whether traditional English teaching practices would say those things are valuable or not.
Yeah.
They are.
Yes.
And showing students that you think they are automatically creates a better relationship where learning can happen.
Exactly. Well, thank you so much for your insight and sharing your research with us. I'm thinking that we can probably perhaps invite you back to kind of continue this conversation because I know that there is more there that we can learn from.
Yeah, I'd love to come back for sure.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Looking for ideas this summer to help you engage students in reading in your classroom? I've got your back. I am updating the new curated short stories library with on-demand professional development to help you create your own lesson plans using what you know about your students and our resources. The library also includes an entire year of short story resources we have curated just for you. Who needs new textbooks? Not you. With our curated short stories library, you have links to PDF and or Word files of the short stories you need for your students. Even better, no more hunting for videos or audios to engage your students' interests. I have curated these resources for you and included them in an easy-to-access system on the Rethink ELA website. Just log into your account and download the resources you need to your computer, upload them to your school's private course management system, or display them on your classroom interactive board. Not a member yet? Just go to rethinkela.com/curatedlibrary and join us.
Thank you for listening to Rethink ELA Podcast. I'm Michelle Waters, and I can't wait to give you a few resources I've developed to help you create a student-centered, collaborative, and creative learning environment. Download these resources when you join our mailing list at rethinkela.com/news.